Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program today, new border reform aims to cut delays and boost African trade. The Home Affairs Minister up in a moment. Outrage as the Irma Stern Museum shuts its doors in Cape Town. Our new tourism boom, what's behind South Africa's new surge. And new data shows pay rises lag soaring living costs in South Africa. It's Wednesday, the 5th of November. Now, Parliament has now passed the One-Stop Border Post Bill, which, as I understand it, aims to streamline movement with neighbouring countries by creating single inspection zones and modernising port operations. The reform is being billed as a real catalyst for efficiency, investment and deeper integration into African trade corridors. But is all of this going to work? Well, I want to discuss the implications, the timelines and also the risks. I'm in conversation with Leon Schreiber, who is the Minister of Home Affairs. Minister, you've described this bill as pro-growth reform, your words, that will cut border delays. Are there hard timelines and performance benchmarks that are going to prove to us that this is all working?
Hi, Jeremy. Good to be with you and the listeners again. I think I'd just like to say firstly that this is part of the broader reform picture that we are driving in this Home Affairs ecosystem, which includes the Department of Home Affairs as well as the Border Management Authority. And one of the first things I said when I came into this office was that we need to reposition Home Affairs as an economic enabler, that we had been neglecting the economic power of this portfolio for too long, and that it actually is one of the core areas where we can begin to drive economic growth and job creation in South Africa. So we've done a ton of initiatives that I think we've spoken about before, the electronic travel authorization that's now being rolled out, that's boosting things like tourism. But this is a very catalytic component of that reform, because what the One-Stop Border Post Bill does is it now creates the legal framework, it gives us the legal tools to actually regulate more efficiency in the border environment. So from a legal perspective, it empowers us to create these common control zones. As the title suggests, instead of a truck or cargo stopping twice, filling in the same piece of paper twice, dealing with the same procedures twice and losing, you know, hours or even days when things are bad, we are now able to integrate that into these common control zones with neighboring countries. So that is an efficiency gain in and of itself. But beyond that, we are pushing to use this law as a catalytic moment to actually remake the way in which the borders operate. So in parallel to this process, when you speak about timelines, for example, we are also now finalizing the public-private partnership agreements to physically rebuild the 6 busiest land borders in South Africa. This is a massive project. It's going to be a kind of infrastructure redevelopment at a very big scale, where now there have been 3 allocations done for Beitbridge, Lebombo, and I think Kopfontein. And then the other 3 big ones are subject to some repricing negotiations. And all of this is obviously subject to Treasury sign-off, but it is not far away. We've made huge progress over the last year in getting these agreements finalized. Once that's done, you're going to have this new legal framework that then is combined with a physical infrastructure project to literally rebuild those border posts. And there, we will then not only have the integration to speed up procedures with neighboring countries, we'll have dedicated lanes for cargo and goods, we'll have digital systems implemented, and in some cases, you even have in Africa now non-stop border posts where you do all of your clearances and all of your conveyance work before you even arrive through digital platforms, and you only get pulled over if there is a reason for an inspection to take place. So indeed, This is happening as we speak. It's not pie in the sky. It's not sometime in the future. And really, within the next few years, has the potential to catalyze regional trade.
Let me pick you up on one point that you've raised. The bill relies, as you say, on coordination and cooperation, I guess, with neighboring governments. But what happens, Minister, if partner states move slower than we are or simply pull back from the agreement in one way or another?
So that is always a risk, but let me make the fundamental point that we as South Africa need to understand. We are the slow one when you look at the African and even the regional context. Zimbabwe and Zambia have successfully operated some of the first one-stop border posts as far as it relates to their border infrastructure. If you look in East Africa, they have really been the model of how the efficiency gains that come with smoother border operations can actually drive growth. So we've seen across Africa, there are over 30 of these one-stop border posts. And a study last year by the African Development Agency found a 42% reduction in waiting time for traders across these posts. There are over 80 more of these one-stop border posts under development in Africa. So the reality is we are catching up. And I think this is really the tone that we are taking in Home Affairs more broadly, that yes, we understand we started this journey as a laggard, but on all of these metrics, whether it is visa reform, whether it is civic services, whether it is our responsibility for the ports, our ambition, and I think what is now starting to being realized, is to become a world leader. We want to get ahead. We want to set the tone. So I think rather than it being a risk that other countries don't want to work with us, the reality is we have not actually fully embraced it until now. And I think that's the difference that GNU reform is making, that we are fully and aggressively embracing all of these catalytic opportunities to start driving growth and job creation. And it has real implications. You can imagine an importer who wants to manufacture something waiting days to get products in. You can imagine farmers trying to export to neighboring countries or get to the port of Maputo with fresh produce that's spoiling. You know, they say time is money, and we are literally leaving money on the floor if we continue and persist with these old failed systems.
And that is all.
Same study.
And that's all. That's all well and good. But let me pick you up on this. The bill, as you've just said to me, is promising faster cargo movement. But Minister, you've got to balance speed with border security, smuggling risk, and also illegal migration. How are you going to do that?
Yes. Well, the whole point of what we're doing is that we need to move to a risk-based approach. We have to become risk managers rather than gatekeepers. The reality is when you have a gatekeeping culture, you actually make it impossible for people who are complying with the law to actually do their business and cross borders and transact the way they should. And in the process, you're focusing all your attention on the law-abiding customer, and things are slipping through the cracks on the other side because you don't have capacity. When you become a risk manager, you use things like one-stop border posts, like digital transformation, like technology and surveillance, to actually identify which of these conveyances are risky. And then you create a good experience for those 9 out of 10 traders who are doing the right thing and who simply want to help grow our economy to have a good and well-facilitated experience. And you actually have a much stronger ability to enforce against the wrongdoers. And this is where the Border Management Authority has such potential for our country. It has set up a national targeting center. It is working in an intelligence-driven way, but it doesn't have the resources it requires to fully roll out this kind of intelligence-driven border management. But we have proven the concept. I mean, you will remember, Jeremy, not long ago, it was a very common sight to find, you know, buses of people almost on a daily basis where people are just crossing. And it really was an environment where people felt there was no control. Those kind of things have meaningfully reduced. And that's happening with the constrained resources we have. So I think all of this takes us towards being risk managers, zooming in where there are problems, but not trying to shut down people that are doing the right thing.
Dr. Leon Schreiber, Minister of Home Affairs, thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, the shock closure of Cape Town's Irma Stern Museum has triggered a wave of outrage, art world alarm, and also tough questions about governance, heritage protection, and cultural stewardship. The museum, it's built around the home and studio of one of South Africa's great modernists, is an irreplaceable national treasure. Yet it now stands shut amid financial strain, institutional tensions, and a degree of confusion over the role of the Irma Stern Trust and the University of Cape Town. Now, with art lovers mobilizing, trustees under scrutiny, and fears about the fate of a collection, which I understand is worth hundreds of millions of rand, I want to ask this question: was the crisis avoidable? What happens next? And with me now with an expert view is Frank Kilbourn, who is chairperson of Strauss & Company. Frank, a very warm welcome. And maybe I should start with this. How did an institution of this cultural magnitude reach closure without what seems to be transparent consultation or any kind of public notice?
Yeah, Jeremy, that is indeed a good question. I think the financial difficulties that the museum experienced is shared by a lot of the museums in South Africa. A lot of the cultural institutions such as that receive very little government support and is very reliant on visitors to fund their bills, and that's always been a very difficult model. What went wrong here is not so much the concerns about the financial model, but the fact that the public and the greater art industry weren't taken into the confidence to try and assist in finding alternative ways to keep the museum maybe open and to start a process of consultation earlier about potential options to make sure that it's financially viable long-term. I think that is the major concern. It really came as a shock to people.
Frank, who are we talking about? Who should have taken those stakeholders into confidence?
To a large extent, university, the partnership between the university and the trust lasted for a very long period in time. And I think people get internally focused with all the challenges in running an asset and forgetting that it is really, to a large extent, also a public asset. And as a result of that, you should draw more role players into that conversation. I don't think there was anything done behind the scenes that is really bad or negligent. I just think it was a complete underestimation of the importance of this institution in the public eyes. And if you and I know that something like that is really important, we'll go about with a lot more circumspection. So I think greater consultation would have benefited both parties.
Which I guess, Frank Kilbourn, begs the question, should a single university, which we know is under budget pressure, actually hold custodial authority over a cultural asset like this, one of national importance?
Of course, it's a vexing issue. I think there are many buildings that are maintained by universities of which they're battling to find the funds for. So it is a really much bigger issue, Jeremy, at large. But if we focus on the Irma Stern Museum, I think the partnership worked for many years very well. But it's really incumbent on us now to find alternatives to alternative funding model going forward. And I think I am heartened by the fact that Nedbank has asked for a public participation process. But I think much more important is that it is really too big a task for any one party to run a trust that carries the legacy of such an important artist without an advisory board or people from the industry giving input to it on how it should handle that enormous task. And I think that's where a significant change is needed.
So in your opinion then, Frank, what's the ideal model going forward?
Yeah, Jeremy, I don't have a 100% answer to you to that because, as I said, many museums face the same challenge. But I think if you involve a larger body of industry-related people who feel very passionate about this, you will find alternative sources of income and not rely on one or two parties alone. I think it's very important that all the people who have so passionately expressed their concerns also get involved in finding solutions going forward, and that requires financial solutions as well. I don't think it's sustainable always for the trust to keep on selling assets in order to fund its operating activities. We're going to have to sit down and find out what a better commercial model will be to make the museum sustainable.
And to the best of your knowledge, has that process started?
I think there's a lot of discussions going on behind the scenes, and I think the process has started, Jeremy. I'm not au fait with all the conversations, but I know that we've definitely been involved with a number of discussions now with people that are very involved in the industry, that are very passionate about South African art. And I think there's a great sort of desire from the public to make sure that this institution sustains itself. Yeah, we all accept the model might change a little bit, but fundamentally, she's the sort of poster woman of South African art. And I think it's very important that she maintains a high public visibility.
Is there any concern within the art community that the artworks themselves are secure, insured, and maintained during closure?
I don't really think there's any reason to be concerned about that. I think the trust has always been very mindful of its obligation to ensure these works and to keep them in a safe space. The concern arose over time that because of the age of the building and the really a significant need for rather meaningful repairs to the Furs in order to bring it closer to museum standard, that the curatorial integrity of the works could be compromised by things such as damp and so forth. And that was always a big concern to the trust. So I can really assure the public that I think the trust will do a very solid job of making sure these works are very well protected.
But you've got to ask the question, I guess, is that if the condition of the building was known to the trust, surely a sustainable preservation plan should have been developed a lot earlier, which patently didn't happen.
Yes, I think, you know, in situations such as this, where you deal with a private sort of institution such as the trust, which is managed by a single entity, and you deal with a building that's maintained by a university in respect of which it's not a core asset, you're always going to find a complicated situation, which is not optimal under these circumstances. I think with the benefit of hindsight, this process should have started much earlier with a much broader forum.
Frank Kilbourn, thank you very much indeed. Chairperson, Strauss & Company, I appreciate your time.
MoneyWeb at midday. For all your up-to-date stories.
Now, new data shows the country welcoming over 1 million more international visitors between January and September this year compared to the same period last year, putting arrivals, as I understand it, at around 90% of pre-COVID levels. And obviously, this is pointing to a good, solid recovery. The Tourism Business Council says the next big push must be to unlock travel visas, accelerate the new electronic travel authorization system, and also stabilize South African tourism if the country is to hit its target of 15.6 million visitors by 2030. Well, let's give you a greater sense of what needs to happen. Chifiwe Chivenga is with us, who is Chief Executive Officer of the Tourism Business Council. So, Chifiwe, welcome. And roughly 90% of pre-COVID arrivals. What's the one thing, do you think, then, that's going to unlock that final 10%? What do we need to do?
Well, indeed, we are at around 90% of the pre-COVID numbers, which is 2019. And we need to keep in mind that we have been out of COVID for a few years now. So we still need to recover the few years that we've lost in terms of, the growth part of tourism. But one of the things that's quite critical in unlocking the next 10% would be, as I've said, how we work together with South African tourism in terms of repositioning South Africa as a tourist destination is critical. How South African tourism is stabilized is critical. And how the provinces show up, both domestically and internationally, is critical. And these are the provincial tourism authority. But it's important that we note that this rise in numbers in terms of getting to 1.1 million more tourists same year up to September versus the previous year, it simply means that the private sector have been hard at work through different products that we have in the country, be it hotel groups, be it safari lodges, and many others, and what we call DMCs, the destination management companies or tour operators, have been hard at work in positioning South Africa as a preferred destination. And this is a testament of their work, together with the work that we did with Trevor Noah, in positioning South Africa as a destination. Because in travel and tourism, you've got to invest early to start to see results. It takes about an 18 months lead time to 2 years to start to see the results of the work that was put in. So this is the results of that work that has been put in by private sector to make sure that South Africa is viewed as a top destination.
But notwithstanding the work that the private sector is doing, none of this effort is being assisted in any way by the ongoing instability that exists in South African tourism. And that remains a big problem, a stumbling block, doesn't it?
It remains a big problem. What we prefer is a functioning South African tourism board and the staff, and to ensure that, you know, they execute the mandate that they're given through the Tourism Act to market the destination in the markets that we prioritize. That has been lacking for the past few years. And we cannot attribute this to the work that have been done through South African tourism, because there's been different changes, you know, that are known in public. This is purely private sector, men and women within this industry who travel overseas, who goes and make deals, and who convert awareness into an actual booking. And someone arriving here in South Africa, the airlines that are doing the work in making sure that they open new routes. This is a testament to private sector working hard, because we know the value of tourism. We work within this space. This is where we get, you know, our bread. So it's very important that we keep it going.
It seems to me, Chifiwa, that the progress then is being made in spite of any intervention by South African tourism. And in effect, what I'm hearing you say is that the body is almost rendering itself irrelevant.
Well, if the body itself does not do what it's supposed to do, in the public eye and in the eyes of the taxpayers and everybody else, it will render itself not so much useful. But we don't want that to happen. We want to work together, because this is where, you know, some of the money that's allocated to promoting tourism goes to. So we need to make sure that it's functional, and we need to make sure that, you know, it does what it's supposed to do. That's the most ideal position, and that's what other countries do. If you go to Australia, you go to Kenya, you go to Brazil, you get bodies that are functional, that are going to international trade shows and so forth and so on. What we have done, we've started working with the current leadership to say that, how do we ensure that we work together as a team without any interference? Because business, as you know, works with predictability. We need to know that in the next 5 years, these are the international trade shows that we're going to do. These are the campaigns that we're going to be running. These are the road shows that we're going to be going on in various countries, so that business can then prepare and participate and convert awareness into an actual person who gets on the plane and arrive here in South Africa.
When you say without interference, that's a subtle way of saying to the minister, back off.
Well, what we're saying is that, you know, we need predictability. We need professionals who understand tourism to plan in advance. We cannot have a situation whereby, you know, we just make a decision now and say, no, we're going to go and attend the trade show now. You know, as a private sector, we're not sitting on a lot of cash. We plan. So we want predictability, and we want to make sure that we know what's going to happen in the next 3 to 5 years. We do understand that in marketing, you need to change tactics. That's given. But certain things that are set needs to be set. And there shouldn't be any interference from those that are not professional in those spaces. People who are professionals must be given a space to do what they're supposed to do and bring results. They need to be judged on results without being interfered with. I always say that when you have executives who are employed to do a certain function, they are judged based on the results. Whether it's an executive of a bank or an insurance company or a hotel group, you produce the results, you judge on the results. But you cannot have any interference and delays and issues of unpredictability infused into the system. That doesn't work well for business. And we need to get away from that and make sure that there's fluidity in the things that we're doing.
All right, let's pivot away from that, and let me ask you about how critical you believe the rollout of the electronic travel authorization process is, and what your expectations of timelines are. Because unless that happens, I imagine you're not going to get that influx of visitors that we need to meet that target.
Yeah, absolutely. That's very critical, because the ETA, as we call it, it's one of those tools that we have been advocating for, to say we need to open up certain markets. And these markets are China and India. We've done some, what we call the trusted tour operator scheme, which is operating well. But we're not seeing a lot more numbers coming into South Africa. And the trusted tour operator scheme focuses on group travel. So we need to also focus on individual travel, or fully inclusive, you know, travelers that want to come to South Africa. So we need to open that market and make sure that people are able to apply and get visas swiftly, and they're able to travel. That creates predictability. China, India are the next big things. There are markets in Eastern Europe that are part of the European Union the likes of Latvia, Lithuania, and others, they still require visa to come to South Africa. We introduced the e-visa, but it has its own problems. So the ETA should be the solutions to all those things. We need to do something in Mexico and many other markets that we need to open up. But the most important thing is that when we introduce the ETA, we need to make sure that it's backed up by IT systems that will enable us to move as fast as possible. Right. There's nothing worse than introducing something when people get to the airport, they're unable to move faster because there's not enough bandwidth or there's not enough, you know, warm bodies to assist. We need to make sure that in whatever we do and whatever we introduce, people are able to move fast enough. Then we will unlock a whole lot more tourists. Well, in the next 18 months, we'll see something else.
Well, thank you very much, as always, for that very blunt assessment. That's Chifiwa Chivenga, who is the Chief Executive Officer of the Tourism Business Council of South Africa.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, there is absolutely no doubt that South Africans are feeling the squeeze. Wages are rising, but nowhere near fast enough to keep up with the cost of living. Electricity tariffs, food prices, and transport costs continue to climb faster than most annual increases, and stagnant economic growth means little bargaining power for workers. Real income for lower-earning South Africans has gone backwards in recent years. Many households now carry debt just to cover basics. So that is a very gloomy picture. Well, let's discuss this in a little more detail and where we're heading as far as this particular debate is concerned. And we welcome back to the program Dr. Chris Blair from 21st Century, the South African remuneration and HR analytics firm. Chris, maybe just a broad overview and welcome to you. Why are salary increases consistently lagging behind essential living costs like food, transport, and power? It's difficult to put your finger on it. There's not a single reason, is there?
No, Jeremy. I think that the problem stems from that we have a CPI that's measured with a basket of goods, and the majority of workers are their basket of goods is not that CPI basket of goods. So that's the fundamental problem. So the ones you've mentioned, electricity, fuel, cereals, or basic food goods. The inflation rates are much higher than the 3.5% CPI that's quoted now. So they're probably more between 10 and 15%, as you know. So a lot of the lower level employees that are earning wages where they're kind of living, I won't say hand to mouth, but they certainly don't have a lot of disposable income. Most of their spend is going on those goods that are much higher than the salary and wage increases, which at the moment are about 6%. So you could look at saying that their effective CPI is say 10%, the salary increase is 6, and therefore they're going backwards by 4% every year.
Chris, is it possible to pinpoint at this stage which income groups in South Africa are losing the most purchasing power right now?
Yeah, so definitely it's your lower income groups because their effective CPI. So certainly, you know, your entry level people, but then your unskilled labour are suffering tremendously, and even a level up from that. So probably if you look at the CPI basket, it's kind of matching more your middle income earners, and they are feeling less of the pinch. Funnily enough, the top income earners, not top, but certainly the upper end, are also feeling it because they pay for private schools, private medical aid, and all of those things also have a very high inflation rate relative to the CPI basket. But I would say the real problem sits at the bottom end.
And the consequence of this is that it's weakened workers' ability, I imagine, to negotiate fair increases.
Absolutely. And that's driven by the huge unemployment in the country, where at those unskilled levels, the person's competing with a huge pool of unemployed people who would just be grateful to get a job. So they don't really have, unless they have a union representing them that that does the negotiation on their behalf, they really don't have any leverage on the employer, because if they don't take the salary the employer offers, the employer will just go to the next person who will take the salary.
Which puts enormous pressure on companies themselves. And I guess it raises the question about whether organizations are pegging increases too tightly to headline inflation rather than real household inflation, as you've outlined to me.
Correct. That's exactly it. So when you look at what is the number one indicator that companies use for their salary increases at CPI, and they're using the basket as defined in South Africa, not the inflation rate by, let's call it, income level, which would be remarkably different. So there is a higher increase for low-level people, but it's not significant. This particular year, the increases for executives is 5%, and increases for low level between 6 and 6.5. So it's still not keeping you ahead in terms of the erosion of your salary each year.
But difficult for companies to recalibrate or alter their thinking in this respect, surely.
Absolutely, because it's been used for so long. And there has been done some work around the real inflation rate by income level. Some companies are starting to use that, and they definitely use that when they try to, or they aspire to get to a living wage, what's called a living wage, not your minimum wage. But that is a changing trend, which hopefully will help the low-level employees if companies do adopt that as a strategy and keep it going for a number of years to kind of catch up, if you can call it that.
So surely organizations need to be a little more creative then. Maybe they need to do more in linking pay to productivity, for instance.
Yeah, correct. So companies do that, and it is a fairly widespread where individual performance is also factored in. So the CPI is like the anchor point, and if you get a high performance rating, which means your productivity is better, then you get a higher increase. But the problem with that is that the performance ratings is a bell curve. You get kind of 50% above the expected performance and 50% below if it's a good performance system. And therefore, half the people are getting poorer and half the people are getting less poorer.
Dr. Chris Blair, as always, thank you very much indeed for the insight. I appreciate your time. And that's where we are going to leave it. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.